Session number 12385, Reel 7.
Bill Williamson, Reel 7. Okay. Right, Karen, you were just saying about
yes.
this.
So well,
you're back in Britain now. Are you Glasgow or... You
no, I went back to Canada now, right. But...
And what year is this?
I would say this must have been about 1933 or 34. And then I went to Halifax, there I was engaged in different sorts of jobs, mostly in the lumber camps there, and I think also in the the labor camps that the government put the single men Canadians into that and I was agitating for better conditions there, or the abolishment of these camps. And then
can you tell me a bit about that, Bill? How did you come to be in these camps? Where were these camps?
These camps were scattered all over Canada, mostly in the west and the north, in northern Ontario, but mostly in BC and in Vancouver Island. But not even Vancouver Island so much, because they tried to locate these... can you switch off just for a minute?
So what were they called?
Relief camps. They were... when there was a mass of unemployment in Canada, worse even than the United States, this was now at the height of the Depression, and they were trying to herd, or because they were frightened of all these young men congregating in the cities, that they would start a revolution or something that, or at least cause great trouble. So they tried to locate these relief camps as far away as possible from big centres, towns. There would be a small town, perhaps 10 miles away. And there they provided them, I think, with two or four packs of cigarettes a week, each one with 20 cigarettes, of course, and 20 cents a day, and your food and board, of course, varying from one relief camp to another. Some were pretty primitive, other ones a bit better. Some the food was terrible, some it was better. Most of the fellows that I've heard talking about it afterwards or writing about it said all the food was atrocious, but possibly that's because they were used to mom's cooking and so on, and it seemed terrible to them. But after the Archibald Russell and my other experiences on the road and so on, to me it was passable. Even the worst of them were passable. It doesn't mean to say you shouldn't agitate for better food and, above all, a lousy 20 cents a day. And then they started saying, oh, well, when it rains and you can't go out to work, then you knock off a day's pay. All these sort of things you'd agitate for, and you'd get out these secret camp newspapers, which you mimeographed out and had copies made and so on. I made my way, quite an epic journey in a way. I got to know these people in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and it was a girl and her mother. They were on the left of the sort of of the political movement in Canada, that the girl was a member of the Young Communist League, although even at that time I think it was prohibited, and the mother was what they call a ward healer. At she's sort of hanging on to the liberal where she picked up I don't know quite how to describe a ward healer. I know it myself, but it's someone like on the outskirts of Tammany Hall in New York, if you can. They're agitating behind the scenes, not in the top brass, of course, but amongst minor jobs in the Liberal Party and so on. And anyway, the upshot was that I was going west to join the camp strikers in BC, because they were far better organized out there. And I remember one sunny evening, we all piled in Alice's uncle's car there, and he drove us out to a well-known stopping place on the Canadian National Railway there, where they changed engines. They always stopped there anyway. And it was almost as though you were boarding a ship. I just got off the ship, waved goodbye, and then climbed on the blind baggage behind the tender of the ship. The crew could see me, and there were one or two others already there, but I thought it was strange going by car to a hobo assignment sort of thing. And then I hung in there, and of course every section of the train, when they were steam driven, they had to stop, and the engine was taken out to the loco sheds, and the fires raked, and it was re-coaled and re-watered and so on there. But so that I was on the and I found I was tired of hanging on to the blind baggage behind the tender and the on the front connecting part of the baggage car. So I climbed on the tender and hooked my arm over a stanchion or something, and the guy came up, the fireman who was came up to ease the coal down and so on, took a look at me and said, oh, yes, didn't say anything. Sometimes they're mean and sometimes they're very accommodating. This was a very good crew. Then when we came to the end of the 150 mile thing, I was always at the back of my mind that I thought, well, I'd like to beat Jack London on one of his epic train hobo journeys. And so that when the train came in, pulls, of course, the engine pulls way out near the front of the station. You slip off either beforehand or when it stops, mostly before it, when it's slowing to come into the yards and the station. So then you go round and meet it and catch it when it leaves again. By this time, I think, whether it was the same crew or not, I don't know. But then they said, oh, you're still here, because most hobos, after one section, that's enough. So that I hung in there again. And then, well, it didn't cause all that interest. It was just, and then the same thing happens in the next section, and the next section, and the next section. By this time, they'd passed the words along with new crews coming on. There's some crazy guy that's hanging on there all the time there. I think it took, of course, when they're stopping at each section, when they're recoaling and refueling with the water in the tender and so on, you've got plenty of time to make it and get a bit of grub or do other necessities and so on, so that you started off and it ended by keeping right on to Montreal. And by the end, when it was coming to Montreal, that was 26 hours later, I was still hanging in there, that by this time I was sort of like a museum specimen. That the first thing a new train crew did was to come and look over the rear of the engine to see whether I was still hanging in there. So, of course, all the other guys that had started off with me from Halifax, that just happened to be on the train, had dropped off long ago. And other ones had come on and left in the meantime, but I was the only one who kept...
Did you have anything to eat and drink then?
Oh, yes, because you stopped, you see, at different places, and then you'd have a wash and go to the toilet and then perhaps enough time to grab a meal, because you knew roughly how long. I couldn't tell you how long they stayed there, but roughly how long you had. And then when it came to, by the time we were reaching Montreal, I was almost a national figure, and I'd beaten Jack London's record by about 100% or something. That, and even when we got to Montreal, which of course is a very big station, you've got to drop off well beforehand. And then I caught the same Overland Express as it was leaving, and went up quite a ways up, seeing it was the Canadian National Railway. That was taking the northern route in northern Canada. And I forget how long, but I think I spent another half day on the train there. I think I was just trying to prove that I can be as tough or tougher than Jack London, you know, that there wasn't any real necessity for that. But
how many miles was this altogether?
Pardon?
How many miles was this altogether?
From Halifax, Nova Scotia, to Montreal is 996 miles, then from Montreal, that is maybe a little bit further on the train, because it has to roughly about 1,000 miles, and then with the other two or three sections that I hung on to, it was probably about another 400 miles or something, and then I stopped off there. That then.
Where did you stop?
Pardon?
Where did you stop? Where did you stop?
When it got off there.
Yeah. What was the end of your journey, though?
Oh well, I finished with this with the Overland, this particular Overland Express. I mean, that continued on. And by that time, I think I thought I needed a bit of a rest, so I probably had rested up a day or half a day, and then caught a freight still on the same line. Then this the government of, I've forgotten again, one of the most vicious prime ministers Canada's ever had, R.B. Bennett, I think, that he had the name of a very sympathetic to Hitler and Mussolini, and also it was he who and his ministers who formed the relief camps, he'd issued an edict that no more, because they people were hearing about these relief camp strikes and so on, that more and more were beating their way on towards BC and on the west coast, and further inland and so on, so that I think it was at Sioux Lookout. That was a thing Bennett said, that so far and no further, that no more transients, they call them, no more hobos should be allowed west of that. That if they landed in Sioux Lookout, then a blind eye would be shown to them if they wanted to go back east, but not going west. So I remember as our freight sitting on top of the boxcar looking in there, and when you saw this, there was a big open space. I don't know what it was, just hadn't been built on or something, on the outskirts of Sioux Lookout, and on the right hand side of the depot there was a whole pile of campfires going, or jungles, which are known amongst hobos, call them jungles, where they generally you find one jungle in a town or on the outskirts of a town. That is where a group of hobos, you always know, you can go there and get the tips on which is the best place to catch a train and which is the bad town for bulls and or rather policemen, or which ones will throw you in jail and which ones are easy and all this sort of thing. So it's a sort of free newspaper almost in a way, these jungles there. And also you invariably found a huge stew pot going, mostly with a 5-gallon can of something. The boys have been around begging food or what have you, and everything went into this stew, a mulligatawny stew, and everyone, when they came in, more or less free to partake of this, and they just gave what they could. But anyway, when I approached this town, you see a jungle there, and you see perhaps a few, they're mostly out of sight of the town anyway, these jungles in woodland or something that's overgrown, sort of hidden from the ordinary honest folk of the town. But this was actually dozens and dozens of these, and it looked just as though it was an Indian encampment, with all the smoke drifting up. I remember it was just after sunrise, of all the sun glinting through the smoke from these fires. And when you got off, they said, well, you know, some had been there as long as a month, and it's just impossible to get any further west than this. And some were talking about walking the couple of hundred miles south to the CPR line, or what have you there, that maybe even further. That, but anyway, that we had a sort of conference there. There were some just the ordinary people, but also some people who'd been organizing in the camps before, and they said, well, we've got to get west to join our comrades in Vancouver and so on. So said, well, what I've heard done in Australia when I was there hoboing, I'd never actually seen it, but you get the grease from the axle boxes of all the train, and out of Sioux Lookout, out of the freight yards, you take a slight turn, and then it crosses a small trestle bridge, and then it climbs through a ravine a little bit of a ravine, but it's quite a steep grade there that we said that if we grease all the rails there, that the engine won't be able to hold it, you know, and even if they do try to shoot like hell out of the yards, they'll start slipping and so on, and we'll be able to board it. So we had literally hundreds, I would say, a couple of hundred perhaps, all these people scooping all the axle boxes clear. I don't know, they must have run hot on their next journeys there, and doing it with old rags and so on, putting it on the rail going up. Of course, it's all single track lines there. And then we did that from when I first suggested it to them, that about 8 o'clock. I hate getting my hands messed up, so I was directing them what they should do. So that, and then so we got it all plastered with it. And then the express came down about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, coming the other way down grade, down on the same line. And our hearts were in our mouths, because we thought maybe it'll jump the lines or something like that. But, you know, with all this grease on the things, that going up, it's a different thing, because they just put sand down, and but it just passed down to the station without any trouble whatsoever. And then I learned the great thing there, never be undecisive. By this time, that and you found Mounties everywhere in existence. Everywhere they were standing in the freight yards, and you found the city police and the provincial police. It was swarming with police. We thought, well, we wouldn't make it. Then I thought, well, now what should I do? It started when it was dark, I suppose, getting dark about 8, 9 o'clock or something like that. So I thought, well, I'll place my faith in the still the grease that's on the rail, and started over this very short trestle bridge. By this time, a terrific thunderstorm broke out, flashing lights everywhere, and you could see the train being made up in the yards about a mile away. And you saw the flashlights of all the cops, it seemed.
What were the cops doing then?
They were seeing that no one climbed on the train. They'd had this. They'd brought in cops from all over, apparently, all over the province to stop this.
Which province was this?
This would be Northern Ontario. And the town was Sioux Lookout. So I thought, well, the rain beating down and so on. And I thought, well, what should I do? They can't watch everyone in this great storm. And it seemed something like something from some opera, you know, that some fantastic. It just struck me that the lightning and so on, like a huge symphony going on, and these fireflies going about with the flashlights all over. And I then thought, well, no, I'll. So I made it halfway across this bridge or to the other side, and it was quite a grade. You noticed it even walking. So then I thought, no, to hell with it. I don't think. And then I saw another thing, is that they had two engines in the front of the freight when they'd almost made up the train by this time. And I saw one being shunted in with the headlamp there, and then the other one coming ahead of it, so you could see. Oh, I thought, oh, God, they're going to rush it out with two engines. So I started pounding my way in, back into the freight yards about, and then you, on top of the thunder and the lightning and the flashing of lights, and then the shriek of the very quite different to British locomotives, the shriek of the American locomotives, it sounded all over, and then it would be echoed by this other one, the second one there, and then I could see right on the end they'd got a third as a pusher there, so that and by this time the train was moving and I was heading, pounding down the track as fast as I could go, trying to see that you didn't fall over any of the obstructions they have, the different things for switching the rails and so on. When I was down just on the outskirts of the yard, these huge locomotives, the first one passed me, you know, and it seemed to me going about 60 miles an hour, but I don't know, to this day, I don't know how fast it was going. Maybe 20 miles an hour, maybe 15 miles an hour, but everything was pitch black. Except for the almost continuous flashes of lightning and so on. So I thought, well, could I risk it? No one sane, I think, would do that because also that I thought, well, I'll try and catch the gap between one boxcar and the other. I'll catch the second one because if you catch the leading one and you slip, you fall under the wheels. But there's also a drawback there because each boxcar has an iron ladder going up the side at each end, but it's on one end on one and it's on the other end on the other. So you might be jumping for something that isn't there, so that and to me, this is one of the most horrific moments of my life when I must have been completely crazy and desperate. And I just saw it, and I just saw in a flash go by the sort of join between the two boxcars and threw myself up to the full height. And my hand hit one of the rungs and slipped and caught the next one. And I think it must have been my right hand that caught it, because I swung back and I remember my feet lambing against the axle box of the car. All the time I was wondering, you know, that as long as it hits the axle box, and until I could get the other hand up and then eventually climb up on top. But that was one of the most, horrific 10 seconds of my life, and I managed to make it. And then we got on the thing. And if that wasn't enough, along with the lightning and so on, there are a couple of flashes from some cop's gun on a flat car way back. And I heard afterwards, I don't know whether there's any truth in it, that he was shooting at, it was the chief of police or something of the town who was had a great hatred of hobos. And someone clouted him over the head with a piece of 2x2 and threw him off the train when it was... And he landed up in hospital, so that good job he wasn't killed. Otherwise, there'd have been one hell of a row. But
why were you so determined to get on this train?
Well, because I wanted to get to BC to join the rest of the relief camp strikers.
Before you tell me about this train journey, yes. Can you tell me about the first relief camp you were in?
The first
relief camp you're in, and how you came to be there before you took this big train journey.
Oh, yes. Well,
the first one was in Halifax, wasn't it?
Yes, in Halifax. They were building, I think it is what they is now the Halifax Airport. It was over just out of Halifax across the across the estuary there of the they've got a suspension bridge now connecting it, but they just had ferries then. Again, I should have looked up this. I've forgotten the name of the... It's something basin or something they called it. It was a big sheet of water there. And they were building this airport, and they had this relief camp built there. And also... I was in that, and then...
How did you come to be in that relief camp?
Well,
you've got to apply...
I forget the details of the thing, but as far as I remember, you just apply to the relief camp. Yeah, you apply at the... they've got someone in charge of the relief camp. Above all is the very small military that they had in Canada then, only a few thousand, but some sort of minor military figure he'd be in charge with, a major or something like that. But the day-to-day running would be by civil servant or something.